Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
So the first year we did 140 cases. The next year after we repackaged into the Cobalt Blue bottle, we did 6,000 cases, and that was all in the fourth quarter of that year, and that was the tip of the iceberg. The next year I did, and I built Sky's national distribution network from the ground up. As a kid, I was, I think, 27 when I started there, and I didn't really have any right to be doing this, but nobody else, you know, would step up to do it. So I'm like, all right, well, I'll run with this for a while. So I built Sky's national distribution network after coming up with the Cobalt Blue bottle concept. And in the third year, so first year 140 cases, second year 6,000 cases, the third year we did 200,000 cases. The next year after that we did 400,000 cases. The next year after that we did 600,000 cases. And the year that I left, we were on a run rate to do 1 million cases. And I believe at the time it was the fastest rise in American distilled spirits history for a brand.
What an extraordinary achievement, and again, great training for any brand, but especially a wine brand.
Unbelievable training to understand, first of all, to cut your teeth and understand distribution and how that all works, understand marketing and understand the importance of aesthetics, understand the importance of packaging. These are all things that actually have a thread back to my musical days, mm-hmm. You know. How do you launch a band? How do you organize the creative mind? How do you write a song? What is it going to sound like? What does the band look like when you're playing? What is the messaging of the songs? What are your lyrical content? How does that all work? What are you shooting for? All of that stuff that is the organization of how you form a band, organize a band, launch a band, and have it matter and mean something, have it stick. All of that stuff I've used through brand development in the wine business and the spirits business since then. So, you know, I didn't get an MBA, but I got something that I think might have been more valuable along the way.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, the value created. Hearing you recite the numbers is awe-inspiring to grow a company, especially in that environment. I mean, it was just vodka. I'm sure it was good vodka, but it wasn't anything unique.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of people that would say, you know, vodka is odorless, flavorless, and colorless. Like, yeah. How does it differ? How do you differentiate one vodka from the next? Yeah. And the realities are there are actual differences, and some subtle and some not so subtle differences, but that wasn't necessarily the differentiation that made that work. What made it work was aesthetics, storytelling, the core concept. Of the purity of the product and why it was purified in the way that it was purified to reduce congener buildup and impurities that affect headaches and hangovers and things of that nature. That was a brilliant story. And that was the original owner, Maurice Canbar, deserves all the credit in the world for coming up with the core story, which was all rooted in very legitimate science. Mm-hmm. And so we had a platform, we had a storytelling platform that we could build from. But without the aesthetics, it would have died.
If no one had heard that story, it wouldn't have mattered.
Right.
So that other piece of...
Right, yeah, exactly. So if people aren't somehow compelled in to get over that first hump of why should I be interested, then you don't get a chance to tell the story.
And somehow instinctually and... your life experience, you knew the importance of it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've always thought aesthetics are critically important. You know, it goes back to the crossover point between music and fashion, for example.
Yeah.
You know, those two things are linked at the hip, and you can't really do one without understanding that the other is really important. You know, I don't think you can launch a band without having some fashion sense of some kind. And even the grunge movement, which was anti-fashion, or the punk movement, all of those had serious fashion threads that mm-hmm. that ran through them, whether they knew it or not. Whether they were antagonists to the fashion of the day or not. They were all really, really powerful. And so aesthetics play an important role in creating things that people want to covet.
So this agitative faction, like you describe in the fashion and music, or perhaps yin and yang, what do you think in the wine world in that context would be that counterpart?
In what way?
So you described storytelling as an integral part of marketing with sure. respect to spirits and wine.
Yep.
And with music, there's a fashion component that seeps in,
yep.
whether you're consciously aware of it or not.
Yep.
Is there some that dynamic? There's something with respect to wine. Is it art? Is it something that creates that balance conceptually?
I think all of the same things that influence music can be found in, you know, for me, launching a band is really no different than launching a brand.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of those same threads wind themselves through. The logistics, the mechanics are different, but the conceptual elements are very similar. For example, the conceptual elements of music and flavor, obviously different mediums, and you have to understand the technique of how those mediums work in order to manipulate them in an artistic way. But the concept of harmony and dissonance, for example,
these are two
powerful mm-hmm. concepts in music. Well, they're also two powerful concepts in wine.
Mm-hmm.
Rhythm, the structural elements of rhythm and how melody and rhythm have a relationship, have a structural relationship to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of concepts exist in wine as well. Texture in wine is a rhythmic kind of thing. And so there are energy. Energy in wine is critical. Acid, minerality that give wine vitality and life and so forth. I often think about music and like what I love about music, like the sizzle of an electric guitar. That to me, that's a visceral thing. Well, the sizzle of acid in wine is a visceral thing. And to me, what excites me about rock and roll is that sizzle, you know? Well, what excites me about wine is the sizzle. And so wine to me has to have an acid component. It, you know, when stylistically we think at Hourglass about yin and yang, we think about these counterpositives that are working in concert and at odds with each other. And we want tensional balance. So to me in wine, I want richness on one side and I want that wired against a tensional pull, a tensional counterpoint, an edge, a nerviness, a vibrancy. Because richness by itself is kind of boring. It's kind of one-dimensional. But if you can wire richness up with a counterpoint, a tensional counterpoint, now all of a sudden it becomes vibrant and dimensional and alive on your palate. So music has all of those same kinds of elements in a theoretical way. So if you think that way in music, why can't you think that way in wine?
Well, for starters, you're clearly a brilliant writer. I mean, this was poetry, what you just said.
Well, I don't know if it's brilliant, but
trust me, I know a lot of writers, and I'm sincerely hoping you'll do us all a favor and write a book.
Oh, that's very sweet.
Because yours would be worth reading. No, seriously, this is the type of stuff that I live for, and it doesn't happen often enough. We all talk about those subjects, but not nearly as insightfully as you just did.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, I'm determined to go back in time in this conversation because the fascinating pieces as they weave in and out of what we're discussing is that you're kind of an accidental vintner. You really didn't.
That's a great way. That's very true. Very true.
And there you were realizing that this is your calling. I mean, you're producing tremendous product that people love and crave.
Well, I can't take all the credit for it because we have two really unbelievably great vineyards that have enormous personality. And then I have an incredibly talented winemaking team. I have to give a lot of credit to Bob Foley initially, who set the original template for Hourglass, and now Tony Biaggi, who is taking what that core template that Bob helped us create to the next level, and profoundly to the next level. And Tony's imprint on the wines since he started with us in 2012 have been nothing short of amazing. And he deserves an enormous amount of credit for stylistically getting us to where I wanted to go theoretically. I mean, Tony's the guy who knows how to do that and make that happen. And so, you know, and then we've got this amazing team of people who shepherd those wines and look after the vineyards, and then the sales and marketing team that goes out and represents those wines in a very beautiful, elegant, smart way. It's a team approach. Well, I get to sit here and have the interview, but I don't get to do that without my team.
Yeah, but I can see where they learn. That's easy to see now. So you left you mentioned you left Sky, and you left all the other engagements in favor of Hourglass. Which year was that?
That I left. So I left Sky in 97, mm-hmm. 96, 97. It was the same year that Hourglass really started to bear fruit. We actually did take some fruit in 96. We didn't have very much, and one of the neighbors just bought like a half ton of grapes. And then, so 97 was our first real vintage. So it was in that time frame mm-hmm. that
so you
Hourglass
dedicate
was,
yourself.
It wasn't going to be for another number of years before we'd actually have a marketable product and be in the market and so mm-hmm. forth. So I was doing a lot of other things to kind of pay the rent in that time period.
So when did you give yourself permission that economically it was feasible for you to do this full time?
To do it full time. Yeah. That happened, I would say by really 2005, 2006, the year we bought Blue Line,
yeah, that's yeah.
Then I was in full time. I was, you know, sort of going in stages as we were kind of growing Hourglass a little bit, and there was enough income at a certain point where I could actually kind of pull off of other projects, and then by 2005, 2006, I was all in. And then we acquired Blue Line in 2006 with some partners.
Very good. So you make how many wines?
So we have two estate wines
two
now.
Estate?
The original mm-hmm. Hourglass estate remains the same, 4 acres, Cabernet. Mm-hmm. And then the Blue Line estate is a little bit bigger. We've got 20 planted acres here. We have all 5 Red Bordeaux varietals. And we make varietal releases of Cabernet, Merlot, Cab Franc, a blend from the Blue Line estate. And then we have added, through Tony's genius, we have added several other wines to the portfolio that are kind of outside the two estate properties that we have. So we have a Sauvignon Blanc that we source from 5 different vineyards. And then we've got HG3, which is a second label that we started by declassifying some of the younger vines. We replanted a lot of Blue Line when we acquired it. And so some of the younger vines just weren't putting out enough structure in the wines. So we started this second label because they were more fruit forward and very friendly wines, called HG3. And we now buy contract fruit for that. And it's a blend of Merlot, Petite Syrah, and Cabernet. And it's now kind of taken off on us and done some really fun things with that.
So you have a portfolio that really offers quite a few different options for the consumer.
Yeah, our core DNA is about the estate wines, and it's about mm-hmm. these two magnificent, beautiful properties that we have that have just, you know, incredible personality, and they're differentiated from each other and so forth. That's the core of our DNA, and that's what I love is trying to figure out that puzzle and pull that expression out of that wine. And then HG3 is a really fun component to add to the mix. It's non-estate driven. It's really more about this. It's more of a winemaker's wine, really, than an estate driven wine, in the sense that Tony gets to blend and use his creativity as far as blending is concerned. It's really a study of blending, and it's evolved over the course of the last few years. And those three primary varietals have been kind of the anchor varietals now for the last couple of years.
Any plans to expand on that?
In terms of adding more vineyards?
Adding any other...
We're always kind of playing around with certain things. I would be open to another estate vineyard. Land prices in Napa Valley have gotten just crazy, crazy expensive, and so that's becoming harder and harder to do financially. But we also have... we've got another interesting set of projects that we're experimenting with and playing with. For HG3, we do a lot of experimental lots just to see how they would work in the blends. And so we've got some of these interesting trials that are really, really good wines that we're thinking about the possibility of doing a completely separate brand based on those. So, you know, there's a lot to do with kind of keeping the train on the tracks right now with Hourglass. So we may get there, we may not. I'm not in a huge hurry. We'll do it because it's right, and we'll do it because we're going to have fun with it, or we won't do it.
And it will be strategic.
We will try to think it through so we don't make mistakes to the extent that we can.
If there's one thing that you guys must have learned in this conversation, strategic. Nothing happens just out of thin air. No, knowing you, it would obviously be special and thoughtful and deliberate. So I'm sitting here in Jeff's home, and there's quite a few empty bottles that I'm looking at on the shelf, and kind of envy bottles. And most of them are my U.S., but not all. So I'm curious now about your drinking habits. What's in Jeff's cellar?
Yeah, what you're looking at is just sort of a display of Napa Valley history for the most part. There are a couple of European wines in there that are just kind of fun wines that we've had. But I really, you know, having grown up here, I've felt that it's important to celebrate the history of Napa. Mm-hmm. And I've had the fortune of being around a lot of these vintners, and my dad had some wines, and I've collected wines over the years, and you know, been given bottles and so forth. So I have a pretty deep cellar of Napa wines going back into the early 50s.
Oh my.
And it's shocking how good most of these wines are. And so we're looking at this kind of wall of different wines here, and for your listeners who don't have the vantage point of being here, you know, there are things like 1947 Louis Martini Cabernet, or 1969 Chapelet Cabernet, or 85 Ridge Montebello, 71 Ridge California Isley Vineyard. That's a fascinating bottle. I think it's the only time Ridge had ever made a Napa Cabernet, and it was from the Isley Vineyard. They got it once. One vintage, 1971, and that is a mind-blowing wine. 74 wow. Red Rock Terrace from Diamond Creek, mind-blowing. The 69 Chapelet is the best wine, not only in this flight of wines, but maybe the best red wine I've ever had in my life.
69 Chapelet is the best wine you've ever had in your life.
I've had it four or five times in the last couple of years, and it is, every single time I've had the wine, it's blown my mind. It is everything you'd ever want in an aged wine, with a crystalline purity of fruit that defies its age. And it has years of structure and power left in that wine. I've never had a Bordeaux that could touch it.
That's really exciting and a little scary. I just realized, because first of all, how many bottles of this is left, number one?
Very, very few. The Chaplets only have a handful of bottles. I was fortunate enough. I had opened a bottle of this for Antonio Galloni at a winemaker dinner that we had a few years back, and he really loved the wine, and he wrote a lot about it. And unfortunately, it really messed up the market for it, because now it's mind-blowingly expensive, and they're very, very hard to find.
Especially like in perfectly stored conditions.
Perfectly stored conditions, exactly. Yeah. But he blew this wine up, and the Chaplets called, and they thought that was really cool that I'd opened this bottle for him. So Dominic Chaplet had me over for dinner a couple months ago, and they cracked open a bottle of 69 that they pulled out of their cellar, and I was like, oh my God, this wine is just so unbelievably great.
You know, it's one of those things when you envy yourself when you have something this special, right?
We do this for a lot of reasons, and that's it, right? Like, yeah. Having a transcendent, ephemeral experience of tasting something that's kind of life-changing is just an amazing thing.
And given your degree of exposure, I mean, you taste wines on a regular basis, let's call it that, and to have this kind of, as you describe, a transcendent experience, is a whole other level of recognition of what wine can be.
Yeah, and I mean, listen, we're learning about it every day. The more I learn, the more I realize I don't know, but it keeps me excited to get up the next day and go learn something new and experience something new. And so you do this a long time, and after you put 20 or 30 years of doing this under your belt, you've seen a lot, you've tasted a lot, and all of a sudden you come across some moment like this, and it just stops you in your tracks.
Yeah, no, it's definitely kind of an event unto itself.
Yeah, for sure.
Something tells me you're very involved in blending. You referenced blending earlier.
So I have been. I have enormous respect for my winemaking team, mm-hmm. and Tony is one of the best blenders in the business. So I will be more of a fly on the wall just because I love doing it and it's fun. And I love to be a party to that. But it's really Tony's genius and it's Tony's palate that drives the decision making on a lot of this stuff. There were times early on when Tony was first getting involved with us, 2012, 2013, and so forth. He didn't have the depth of knowledge of our kind of house style, and he knew the wines, but he didn't really know the estates and the properties and how they worked together. So we worked a little bit more in tandem the first couple of years, both from the vineyard standpoint and then in the cellar. And I was probably party to more of the blending decisions on the earlier side of that relationship. I'll still jump in here and there, but there's really no need because he truly is a master at what he's doing, and he doesn't need to hear from me.
Well, we know you're not a micromanager. No, and that's the sign of true leadership, is that you let people do their best work. So this is a general interest question, and I really want to tap into your business acumen, because what you've described in this conversation, there's so many teachable moments, but overall, a very cohesive approach to a business. In wine business, particularly smaller scale producers, I feel like maybe missing some pieces and struggling and such like that. I certainly have talked to a number of them. If you were to give advice to what a business, wine business structure should look like, I mean, mm-hmm. what would it sound like?
First and foremost, have a clearly articulated vision of what you're doing and why you're doing it. Understand before you jump in what you want to articulate and how you're going to do that. Have a story. Have a unique story. And then you have to organize your actions around that vision, that narrative, and that story. And you have to do things that support that, and you have to not do things that diminish that. And it's a process of saying no as much as it is a process of saying yes and being laser focused on that vision. There's a ton of noise in this industry. There are people coming and going all the time. There are brands coming and going. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of brands out there. And most of them, or many of them, lack an articulation of a vision. And you need to stand for something, whatever that thing is. If the art of blending is your thing, you need to stand for that thing, and you need to get really freaking good at it, and you need to scream it from the top of your lungs, and you need to tell people why what you're doing is differentiated from all of the other people around you who are blending, and why that matters. You've got to be a good storyteller in that sense. And then you have to understand the mechanics of how sales and distribution and brand building and marketing all work. And if you don't understand or can't get the right people around you that understand all of that, you can make the greatest wine in the world, but now you got to go out and sell it. And our industry is complicated when it comes to selling. You have various tiers that you have to sell through, the three-tier network that you have to sell through. You have to understand that three-tier network and how it works. It's very congested. It's very convoluted. And if you don't understand it, and this is where my experience at Sky really paid big dividends, because I went out and built Sky's national distribution network, and I learned from the ground up what three-tier distribution means and how to move the needle through three-tier. And most small wineries really struggle with that. And then you've got to be able to figure out how to fit your narrative into vehicles that will carry your brand forward. So, you know, are you going to engage social media? If you are, how are you going to do that? What are you going to do? Why are you doing it? Are you doing it with purpose, or are you just shotgunning information out there that's not really forwarding your brand cause? Are you going to use public relations to get the message out? Are you going to use word of mouth? Are you going to have just a direct-to-consumer platform? Are you going to have a direct-to-consumer platform and a three-tier platform? How is that all going to work together? So there's a lot of layers to it. It's a complicated thing. And now is not a great time to be jumping in. The barriers of entry have raised significantly over the last few years. Probably when we started, I incorporated in 2000, and I think 2001 was our first sales year for Hourglass. It was kind of the Wild West. You could kind of fall out of bed, and if you made reasonably good wine and you had a reasonably interesting story, you could get some attention. Mm-hmm. Now there's just so many brands and so much proliferation that it's really hard. And a lot of the storytelling and a lot of the, you know, people kind of go to the same consulting winemakers and the same consulting vineyard consultants, and they use the same graphic designer, and they use the same, you know, same this, same this, same this. And those stories are frankly just kind of boring, mm-hmm. and tired. And it's like, how do you differentiate?
That's the thing. I mean, you've literally watched Napa scene evolve. Mm-hmm. And you just said you almost anticipated my next question, because, you know, in not so distant past, it took a good score and corresponding shelf talker or just word of mouth to actually be able to sell the place a product, particularly with limited production. That's no longer the case. That's completely changed.
You can't market a wine on a score anymore. I mean, if you get 100 points, we've never gotten one. We've never gotten 100 points. I'm kind of proud of that, actually.
That's interesting.
I mean, listen, the review process has been very good to us over the years. I don't think it means that much anymore. It used to matter a lot. Mm-hmm. You get 100 points, or you get 98 or 97. We've gotten plenty of those. They don't move the needle now. They used to. They used to move the needle a lot. Mm-hmm. But now you have to have... Now, listen, you have to be a professional. If you want to succeed in this business, you can't come in thinking that this is a lifestyle play and that that you're going to kind of waltz your way in, and you've been really successful in some of the thing that you've done in your life. And this is a different animal. And if you're not engaged all hands on, chances of you being able to make it a sustainable long-term business out of this are really low. So you have to engage the industry as a professional and take it seriously as a professional. Learn. And, you know, a lot of people are motivated by the kind of the sex appeal of the industry and not the back end where all the hard work really is.
Well, you're a poster child of being around iconic individuals, but you took a very practical approach, even if it was subconscious. And you truly learned from
them. Well, you know, God, I learned by guys like Jack Davies at Schramsberg and Robert Mondavi and Chuck Carpi, and some of these trailblazers. They were hard workers. First of all, they were all in. They were completely passionate. They weren't doing other things. They may have come from other places, but once they were here, they were all in. And they worked really hard. And so if you're going to dabble, it's probably not going to work out that well. You got to be all in.
But if you're all in and dedicated, do you think there's room?
Sure. There's always room for, I think there's always room for people who are passionate and who are all in.
Is there anything missing that you've observed, not just in Napa scene, that might be the most immediate example, but anything missing in the wine industry, in the wine world, any conversations that should be happening that are pressing that are not?
From a business standpoint, it's just professionalism. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a lot of conversations with a lot of the French immigrants who've come over and who are living here now, but they grew up in Bordeaux or they grew up wherever they grew up in Europe. And it's like the difference in professional disciplines for the Bordelais. The Bordelais have been doing this for hundreds and hundreds of years. And they have adapted a very methodical, professional approach to their craft. They're not dabblers. They're serious and they're in it for the long haul. There's too much money in Napa at stake for our industry not to grow up in that way. But there's a lot of behavior here that just isn't terribly professional. Mm-hmm. And that will sort itself out over the course of, you know, however many years. But, you know, we're only 50 years into this. So the next generation will sort all that stuff out. Are there other discussions that are not being had? Oh, I'm sure we could go down that for hours. But, I mean, to me, the state of the industry is in a pretty healthy place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that there will be I think there's probably a reset underway for Napa. And that's pretty common for young industries that have sort of gotten to a certain platform of success. And now they've got to sustain that success. I'm not worried that will happen. It will happen. It is happening. But there'll be winners and losers in that. I mean, if you're not all in, you're not going to survive. It's just, that's as simple as it gets. If you're not making smart, methodical decisions that are professionally oriented, I don't think, you know, you're not willing to work your ass off. I don't know if the brand will have a long arc.
A lot of conversations center around dollars and cents, and the prices in Napa Valley obviously have risen, and in many ways, legitimately so, because the labor costs have gone up, the cost of land. I mean, it's not arbitrary, but people tend to just notice the price point and not attach it to the root cause of why it might be that.
Right.
What is your perspective on that?
I still think Napa is an incredible value.
Okay.
At any price point.
Mm-hmm.
When you consider the quality that Napa puts out relative to its competitive set, I think it's discounted in the world. Mm. I mean, look at Top Flight Bordeaux, look at Top Flight Burgundy. Those prices are well north of our top brands.
Mm-hmm.
And then you take it every tier down and you look at, to me, I look at kind of, you know, I'm a consumer too. So I look at the return on my invested dollar in wine.
Mm-hmm.
The quality is in Napa. Napa delivers extremely consistently at a very high ratio of cost to pleasure.
I'm very glad to hear that, because I feel that way as well. But that, again, that's not the conversations that are happening at large.
Now. You know, it's you go to Premier Napa and you see these eye popping numbers, and like, mm-hmm. oh my God, how can people pay that kind of money for, you know, a bottle of wine? Or you look at Screaming Eagle or Harlan or, you know, whatever, and it's like $800 or $2,000 or whatever it is. And those numbers jump out at you, but that's not the complete story. And quite mm-hmm. honestly, I'm not sure that those wines aren't worth it, because if you look at their qualitative equal around the world, I think those wines stand shoulder to shoulder qualitatively, and they might even be a little less expensive, especially when you consider the volumes that are created. Look at Harlan. That's a phenomenal bottle of wine. I think, I could be wrong about this. I don't track it year in and year out, but I think they're around $800 a bottle at release. That's a hell of a lot of money for a bottle of wine.
Yep.
But you compare it to its qualitative equals in other parts of the world, that's actually, and especially for the quantity that's made, mm-hmm. they make a couple thousand cases of Harlan.
Yes.
Latour makes what, 45,000 cases a year? I mean, come on. So the scarcity element yeah. of it is part of what drives pricing. And you know, okay, these are the top-notch extreme elements of pricing. But then you look down in the, you know, $50 to $150 price range, and the vast majority of wines coming out of Napa are really, really good at that price range, and probably significantly better than a lot of competition around the world. It's not saying that there aren't other regions that are competitive threats to us from a price to quality ratio. There are other really great regions that are doing interesting things and so forth. But I think if you look just sort of across the board, I think Napa produces extremely well for where it's priced.
And I think the quality has risen exponentially.
And it will continue to. So we're not just sitting on our hands here either. Yeah. I mean, we are, as a wine culture, pushing to make better and better and better and better wines. So, I've always said that our best wines haven't been made yet.
Wise words. You made a comment earlier that really caught my attention. You said the next generation will sort it out, meaning that somehow that whole dynamic that's happening that you described, the adjustment that's coming.
Yep.
That's in the hands of, would you say millennials or...
Well, yeah, certainly millennials will play a role, and the generations that follow them as well. I mean, mm-hmm. we're only 50 years into this experiment, so the reset that I think is sort of going on right now will take some time to play itself out. And so, my kids may be, you know, dealing with this at some point. You know, how does Hourglass stack up amongst its competitive set? Obviously, you know, I've still got a few years left in me, and I'll be fighting that fight for a while. But it is a generational game.
So, fleshing out just a little bit, is it the authority piece that plays an integral role? How they consume information, how you develop trust on the consumer side? Is it something that we're getting correctly, or do we not?
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's a continuous effort to tell your story as a collective of Napa, or as an individual wine within that collective set. You got to tell your story, and you got to tell it a lot, and you got to tell it over a long period of time, and you got to tell a story that has resonance, and it has resonance because it has authenticity. If you don't have authenticity, you don't have much. And so, you know, I think looking downstream 100 years or so, and then looking back, the brands that will do really well will have an authentic story. They'll have an authentic through line, and they will continue to fight and push to improve the quality of their wines over a period of time.
So from the communication point of view, I'm always curious about it, because it's such a hot button. There's so many complaints about millennials specifically being disengaged with the wine industry. I've come to believe that it's the wine industry's responsibility, the onus is on them, to communicate, as you described, succinctly, effectively, and engagingly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we have all the tools to do it. We just have to figure out how to organize them. I mean, social media is a very powerful thing, but you got to know what you're doing when you use it. And you can't just turn on the fire hose and expect it to work, you know. you have to know how to aim it and point it and, and do the right things with it. And again, it comes down, at the end of the day, it all comes down to storytelling. And what's your message? What's your vision? And are you true to that? And are you doing things that are supportive of that? And does the vision yield something that people find compelling? And if it does, then you just keep doing it and doing it and doing it, doing it. I don't know. I don't think the millennials are so ultimately different than everybody else. At the end of the day, they want to drink something that tastes great, you know, don't they?
I think that's just, yes, human nature.
More,
they want to be.
I don't think it's more complicated than that, frankly.
No,
at the end of the day, maybe it's just about pulling corks.
That is, I almost want to end in the sentiment, but I want to just flesh it out just a little bit, because for those of you guys that just met Jeff and the brand, it's just so important that you think about your own consumption. And, you know, my selfish hope, because I am a huge fan of it, that you will try Hourglass brands and, you know, find something that appeals to you. And in that vein, I really want you to talk about the empowerment piece, because I suspect that's where this is going to wind up. You have lived an empowered life. You found answers that fit you. And when you didn't, you kept looking. And that's a huge message. And it applies to wine squarely. Finding your palate, finding your stride. What say you to the consumer? If somebody's listening somewhere far away and really is quite intimidated by this big, beautiful world of wine that
can be intimidating. So, God, I've been doing this a long time, and sometimes I get intimidated by it too. It's just keep experimenting. Keep cracking bottles and experiencing wine. And if you're curious, learn about the regions and learn about the players who make up those wineries and what their vision is. And try to find, I would try to find people in the trade who have a high degree of integrity and can understand what your likes and dislikes are, and explore those likes and dislikes, and then communicate them to those people and have them help you kind of sort through and get a landing zone of some kind. I think the one thing that's a problem is that people get turned off before they get turned on. And so it's so daunting that it's like, I don't even know where to begin and where to try and so forth. I think you just have to jump in the deep end and find an island of some kind that you like. And then from that island, you venture out and try and experiment new things. And you're not going to like everything you try. And that's okay. But you will also discover a world of unique and interesting flavors and experiences and so forth. One of the things that's great about wine is it's not just a great pleasurable beverage that we love to drink, but it's also this social connector. It's a great way to connect with other people who are interested in this thing. And oh God, my favorite part of this whole business is not really the wine. It's actually the people that we meet along the way. How cool is that? And wine is this incredible connector to bring socialization together. And if you can get beyond the initial daunting wall, you get inside. And you know what? Screw everybody who thinks that wine has to be a specific thing or a specific way, or they know better or whatever. At the end of the day, the only thing that matters is your palate. So if you like something, you like it. And it should just stop right there. You don't need affirmation. You don't need other people to tell you whether you like it or not. You either do or you don't. And if you don't like it, fine, move on to the next thing until you find something you like. And then when you find something you like, you've now started to profile. Actually, you've started to profile your palate with the things you don't like too. So take note of the things you don't like, take note of the things you do like, learn why you like the things you like, and keep searching for more of that.
In 1997, I fell in love with a wine that I didn't know. up until that point called Hourglass. And 2019, I'm sitting across from a very wise man whose words I'm falling in love with. Thank you very much for spending time with us. Fantastic conversation, lots of teachable moments. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Thank you.
And thank you. I'm honored.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palette Exposure featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.